Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Madawa, Lapa, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Toca, Pima, Pensacola, Infidel, I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Fair.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jumble Justice Radio Show for this Thursday evening. We want to welcome you to our show, and I think you'll enjoy what we have planned for you tonight. It's called Big City Crime, the violent, the obscure, and some other things. So I think you'll enjoy the unusual stories we have for you tonight. Johnny Cash, we want to thank you for taking us on that trip across the United States, where he hits 90 different cities and states. And, John, tonight would be a good place to skip Omaha, I guess. Omaha had certainly had a tragedy here in the last couple of days, and it's too bad that somebody couldn't have gotten to that character before he killed all those innocent people in the mall in Omaha. But perhaps we'll have time for some more commentary about that next week. But I'm sad that this, as this story unfolds, we talk about how hopeful this young man was. I've seen several stories about that, and you know, of course, there was something wrong with him. But boy, let's don't overdo it. Emily, Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight and for helping us put this technical part of the show together tonight. We're going to go back to some old tricks with Blog Talk Radio, where we have to switch around some microphones and things, and your help is very much appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of our show is as always, we discuss issues, events, news, developments, and the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And I'm always amazed at what's going on in this field in terms of development issues and some of the humor that comes out of some of these stories. And we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. But our show is dedicated to all those energetic police force directors and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. What we try to do is look inside the field of criminal justice and look at the practice, and we don't think any other show on Blog Talk Radio Network is doing that, or any other show that I know of. And someone once said that we're the NPR of criminal justice, and you've heard me say it before, we'll accept that as a compliment. I don't remember who said it, but we remember it. And Blog Talk Radio is a very leading-edge technology. It continues to lead. And Alan Levy is the chief executive officer of Blog Talk Radio. He thought all this up about 18 months ago, and now we're up to thousands and thousands of shows. I read an update in an email to me here yesterday, and it just goes on and on in terms of the variety of shows that are on this network. So what is possible, in case you would be interested in doing something like this, any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own show. Their interest can be from darts to homicide, cigars to astronomy, motorcycle repair. It doesn't make any difference. It could be an education course in a college or university or a high school, and you can broadcast live and streaming audio over the internet, and you can do it worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. I heard Arianna Huffington commenting on an MSNBC show today, and of course she has her own show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, but when you go and look at that billboard of all the shows that are on, you'll recognize literally hundreds of personalities that have a show. Sometimes when they're pushing a book, they'll have a show for a while, and then the show will disappear. But anyway, take a look at Blog Talk Radio. If you can't find something that interests you there, then you're probably not interested in anything. And like I say, if you don't like what you're seeing, like on the back of the Cheez-Its box, that motto says, get your own box, or get your own show. You can certainly do it on Blog Talk Radio, and it's absolutely free. You won't have to pay a penny for it. What we're going to do tonight is, we're going to talk a little bit about some criminal justice news, and there's some odd things out there. There are always hundreds of stories that we could make commentary on, but I've selected about four or five for tonight. And then we're going to take a look at what happens in terms of big city crime, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., New York, Los Angeles. And we're calling this big city crime the violent, the obscure, and the bizarre. And some of the things that are going on there are sort of bizarre. Those of you who want to call in here in the early part of the show, you can certainly do that. You can listen on your computer, of course. If you're listening, you don't have to be told that. You can listen on your Windows Media Player, or you can call in by phone, cell, landline, Skype phone. You can hear the whole show on the telephone. And our number to call in case you want to do that, is 347-996-5983. And again, that is 347-996-5983. And I will mention that all of the shows that we've done in about the last 15 months are actually archived on the Blog Talk Radio site. Just go to Jumble Justice, and you'll be able to replay those shows. They're all 1 hour in length, or you'll be able to download them and store them on your MP3 player, or keep them on your computer and use them later for something. Some of the shows you might feel, you're a criminal justice teacher, either high school or college, you might feel some of those are indeed appropriate for some of your classes to listen to. So all those shows are actually there on the internet site. Audrey, I guess you're all set to go with your blonde joke tonight. And you know, you told me what this joke is about, and I'm thinking that we've already had this joke, but you tell me we haven't. It's just we've had two of them about ice. So here we go. I might point out, ladies and gentlemen, that Audrey is a blonde. She grew up in London, England, and she's been a collector of blonde jokes since she was a small child. And she has a treasure trove of these jokes and these jokes. And here's one of them tonight. Let's see how this one goes, Audrey. Go ahead.
Professor Haley, I thought you will like this blonde joke since it deals with the outdoors, which I know you enjoy so much. Here it is. A blonde wanted to go ice fishing. She'd seen many books on the subject, and finally, after getting all the necessary tools together, she took off for the nearest frozen body of water. After positioning her comfy footstool, she started to make a circular cut in the ice. Suddenly, from the sky, a voice boomed, "There are no fish under the ice." Startled, the blonde moved further down the ice, poured a cup of cappuccino from the thermos, and began to cut yet another hole. Again, from the heavens, the voice bellowed, "There are no fish under the ice." The blonde, now quite worried, moved way down to the opposite end of the ice, set up her stool, and tried again to cut a hole. The voice came once more, "There are no fish under the ice." She stopped, looked skyward, and said, "Is that you, Lord?" The voice replied, "No. This is the manager of the hockey rink."
I like that. That isn't the one I thought you were going to recite tonight. So that was a different one. That's a good one. That's a keeper, as we say. And we'll put that one up near the top of the list. Ladies and gentlemen, every week, in the interest of reducing crime in both the area from which we broadcast and across the United States, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement that I'm sure that they like to be have played, and I'm absolutely certain this must be directed toward the gun-toting criminals and gang members in the state of Ohio. So let's go ahead and play the Ohio Coalition's message and hope that someone sees it tonight or hears it tonight and turns away from their life of carrying concealed weapons.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Oh, thank you very much, Coalition. And again, I hope that the criminals take note when they hear that message. Tonight, I'm going to start off. I know, Audrey, you like this one too. I'm going to start off tonight with a news story that is a little bit bizarre. And one of the things we like to keep everybody updated on, at least periodically, is what's going on with surveillance cameras and what's going on with the taser. We're sort of fascinated with technology and in criminal justice, and certainly there's enough of it that's been very valuable. And here we have an update on what's going on with the taser. And the story goes like this. There's a French businessman, and he's saying that his company is working on putting a taser stun guns on a flying saucer. Can you remember that? Or imagine that? That this thing would zap protesters, evildoers, and anybody else that authorities don't like, says Antoine Dizazzo. And he says that it could be one of the biggest selling items in the United States in Europe. So what will happen, he's developing a mini flying saucer-like drone, which could also fire taser stun rounds on criminal suspects or rioting crowds. I think this thing is going to shoot, like, if I'm not mistaken, five different taser shots perhaps at the same time. But this this would be great for catching carjackers, because you could go after them before they get to the car, I guess, but should be very interesting. He said he's thinking that given the new approach that President Sarkozy and his no-nonsense law and order tactics in France, this might be a big seller. So he's going to manufacture them as fast as he can and hope that he can sell them. I also noticed in Wired magazine that Taser, trying to meet everyone's needs, they're going to come out with a smaller taser that actually looks something like a small portable razor, and it's going to be pink in color, and it's designed just for women. And the idea is that when women go out, you know, they take their keys, a couple other wallet, a couple other items, and now they can stick this very small taser in the purse, and it has the very same punch as the larger, more obtrusive-looking weapons. So if you want a pink taser, perhaps they'll make some other colors that's very small and has the same 50,000 volt whack, then you can get one from this company here probably in a short period of time. Very interesting. I like this idea. We like to talk about things that help to reduce the people's carbon footprints on Earth, and one of the things that causes a larger carbon footprint, of course, is running. And we now have Pine Lawn, Missouri. It's a suburb of St. Louis. And this is one of a number of municipalities around the country that's actually passing a city ordinance against sagging pants. That's right. And what's going to happen is that some people are going to resist this. They think that it's offensive, that it is offensive to those in the hip-hop culture that like to wear saggers, and I don't know what it's going to, well, here it is. It says it's going to, the fine's going to be $100, and then the parents of people who are caught wearing saggers, they can be fined up to $500, and they could serve 90 days in jail. Not everybody's excited about this, but I'm for it. I'm telling you that the lower the sag, the easier it is for the cops to catch the criminals that wear those breeches. So let's go to it. Let them sag low. If you've seen some of those pictures of these folks trying to run from the cops, you'll see that almost any cop on patrol are able to run them down and they're going to catch them. This next story is really something. I don't think I can take this story straight up as it's reported, but perhaps you've heard about this. We have two young guys in the Cincinnati area, that went out and robbed a bank and also a one of these check cashing places called the Hyatt Check Cashers in Mount Auburn around Cincinnati, or in Cincinnati, that is. And they told the judge that the reason they pulled the robbery was they needed college tuition money. And one of the guys is a student at the University of Cincinnati in the College of Engineering, which is a very fine engineering school, one of the best in the nation, I've always been told. And then the other is a drama student at the University of Toledo. But they couldn't think, and their comments was that, you know, they were going to have to drop out of college and they didn't know what else to do. And farther down in the article, somebody actually suggests, have you thought about work? Well, they didn't. And, of course, other people said they could have gotten a loan, and both these guys happen to be minority. And he said there were special places, and some of the guys that run loan services and scholarships for minority groups said that, you know, they could have come to them and they would have made the money. But anyway, they could have gotten 108 years behind bars. Now, we're talking about two financial institution robberies, and having taught a course called Analysis of Robbery for 10 or 12 years, I can tell you that when you do two of them in a row, 20 years is a pretty short time, and they're probably not going to do 20 years. 20 years, actually. You never believe a sentence that's printed in the paper. That's a truism in criminal justice. There's 12 or 14 different ways that that sentence can be changed. But I'm kind of thinking that maybe a defense attorney or somebody told these guys that, you know, pull the college tuition bit. Don't you think? I mean, come on. These are bright guys going to college, and this is the only way they could think of getting their tuition. Of course, they complained about how high tuition. Anyway, you can read the backgrounds of one of these guys if you go to the Cincinnati Inquirer on the Internet and search for this story, but I thought that was kind of interesting. Here's a follow-up on one we talked about a number of weeks ago. We had a two prisoners escape, both of them in prison for murder, by the way, from in Texas, and this is a prison officer's failure to follow procedures created the opportunity for two felons to escape from a work detail and led to the death of a guard, and she fell off a horse. I think you probably remember that. Her name is Susan Canfield. She was 59 years old. She died September 24th of head injuries when she fell from her horse after being struck by a truck driven by one of the inmates during their escape at the Wynn Unit prison in Huntsville, Texas. If you've never been to Huntsville, you got a whole bunch of prisons there. And, of course, you have a very fine School of Criminal Justice, Sam Houston State University. They probably, I'm guessing, produce more fine wardens all the way across the United States than any other university with a criminal justice program. But, anyway, these guys were in prison 50 years for attempted murder, and the other one was serving life, and they were out on a work detail. In Texas, you do they do try to get you to work, and after getting you up at 3:30 in the morning. But, anyway, they investigated, and it said that what happened is this one supervisor allowed one of these guys to get too close to him. There's a distance, 15 feet or whatever they're supposed to stay, and the guy didn't do that, and he was overcome, and that caused the whole chain of events. So that's kind of an interesting story, and when you're supervising inmates, and particularly those who are lifers, I don't think you can ever take anything for granted, that's for sure. One of the things I wanted to mention tonight, I know people know about it real quick, and we need to get to our news audio segments, but there's a great site on the Internet called LibriVox.org. I don't know if you know about that, but it's LibriVox, L-I-B-R-I-V-O-X, .org. And what this does, it has thousands of fiction and nonfiction books that are in audio form, and they're broken down by chapter, and they're on the Internet, and they're absolutely in the public domain, so there's no copyright. You can take those off, and you can play them, and you can listen to some of the great classics. I was listening to Thomas Paine's Common Sense here the last several days, thinking about some of the founding documents and the early history of the United States, and then I also just clicked on, for fun, I clicked on Alice in Wonderland. And what people do is they volunteer their voice, their time, to read these books and log them in. And in the fiction and nonfiction category and poetry and drama, There are literally thousands of these, and they're absolutely free. You can use them any way you want to because it's no copyright violation. So if you got time and you want to listen to some books and you don't have time to read it, drop these things down on your MP3 player, something like that, and you can take it with you either in the car or walking around or whatever. But it's LibriVox.org. Well, folks, Mike, Emily, Audrey, what do you think about some of these news stories tonight? I think we've got some good ones. What do you folks think?
Well, I think what our audio news segments tonight really show is the diversity of crime we have in our large cities in the United States. We know that crime is down to about the lowest rate we have had in 50 years, but we cannot go lax and expect it to stay there.
Well, I agree with that, that's for sure.
I was astounded by the case of the tiny dogs being stolen at gunpoint this Christmas season. Who would believe that? Once all lost $30,000 worth of bedigreed puppies. Just incredible. Emily, what story impresses you the most out of our interviews for the show tonight?
Guns always get my attention, and the Washington D.C. gun case that is before the U.S. Supreme Court is a major development. I enjoyed hearing one of the plaintiffs in that case.
Yeah, that's going to be a major case, for sure.
All in all, I believe our listeners will like the interviews tonight. Oh, and I forgot Professor Haley to mention the story about cyberbullies. That is indeed scary.
Yeah, I did a couple papers here probably 3 or 4 years ago on cyber stalking. I did those with Dr. Nick Valsic at the University of Texas at Dallas, and very interesting area, kind of relatively new area, because we really don't know what to charge some of these people with. And the commentator, the professor in this case, she'll talk about the difference between sort of bullying versus things that are actually criminal. And the argument originally was over, do we already have laws that cover this, or do we have to write new and specific laws? And it almost seems like the more specific the law gets, the more complicated it gets for prosecution. But let's go ahead and listen to the segment here about the pricey little dogs that are being stolen in the large city of Los Angeles.
The NPR shop offers the latest in radio technology, from Wi-Fi to HD, from FM to shortwave. Radio gift ideas are at npr.org/shop.
A crime wave has hit Los Angeles. It involves theft, home invasion, even smuggling. But the burglars aren't after money or jewels. They are stealing small dogs. Here's NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
Little dogs are more popular than ever in the United States. This year, for the first time, the noble golden retriever has been knocked from the top 2 spot on the American Kennel Club's most popular list. His replacement? A tiny Yorkshire Terrier, a little dog that fetches a disproportionately huge price, sometimes more than $2,500. Tina Rowe knows exactly how popular little dogs have become. She and her husband Paul own Puppula, a pet store in the La Mirada suburb of Los Angeles that specializes in pocket-sized dogs. In a playpen at the front of the store, a white Maltese with blobby pink hooded ears and a lively Yorkie greet visitors as soon as they open the door. The Rose became national news this month when Puppula was robbed twice in 2 weeks. The thief got away with over 2 dozen dogs worth more than $30,000 total. Police caught the thief this week, but so far only 3 dogs have been returned. As iron workers put new security gates on the front of her store, Tina Rowe shares her theory about why these dogs were nabbed.
What I could not think is they're just so expensive. They're over $1,000, and most people cannot afford them, and as they want it so bad, I guess that's how they're doing it.
And they're doing it more and more often, not only in Los Angeles, although some of the most brazen examples occur here. In February, a family in Koreatown suffered a home invasion after they placed a for sale ad for the Yorkie puppies they bred. After first posing as protective buyers, two young men returned to the home, and as the apartment's security tape showed, one man forced the family to crouch at gunpoint while his partner chased 4 frisky Yorkies around the living room. actually stuck the puppies into a plastic garbage bag and fled. Thanks to that security tape, Los Angeles detective Luis Corona was able to reunite the puppies with their owners in a few days. Yesterday afternoon, he had the satisfaction of delivering this news about the dog napper.
One of the suspects pled guilty. He went to state prison for 8 years because he used a weapon.
Small dogs like the Koreatown Yorkies and Tina Rose teacup size Huskies, Maltese, and Pomeranians are a hot commodity. That's partly because they're trendy, say the Paris Hilton and her Chihuahua Tinkerbell, and partly because they're ultra-portable. Captain Aaron Reyes of the Southeast Area Animal Control Authority says little dog lust increasingly is driving people to take shortcuts they shouldn't by buying smuggled dogs from Mexico to save money.
Sadly, they'll end up buying these puppies in a parking lot and, you know, meeting someone paying cash, and once these brokers, these sellers, you know, open the door to their car and you see those cute little brown eyes, it just melts your heart and you shell out the cash, you know, without even thinking twice.
Tiny cure bees are a top item on many holiday wish lists this year. The challenge might be buying a dog that's legally cleared for sale and holding on to it. Time for today. Come to love you.
Isn't that incredible that something like that goes on? I never, actually never thought about that. But dogs could be stolen that way. So very interesting. I'm wondering, you know, where do you, I guess, how do you, once you get the dog and you find the buyer, there must be fences that, you know, deal with dogs. I would never think of somebody dealing in stolen dogs, but that must be the case. Very interesting. What do you think about this next story? This is a very interesting one. It has to do with the business of the gun case in Washington, D.C., and this is going to be big news because we're not sure how the court is going to look at this particular case, but tonight you'll get to hear in our audio segment an interview with one of the plaintiffs in the case. And then you hear another gentleman that, you know, is for the D.C. gun ban, and they argue back and forth a little bit about how valuable it's been over the years as the Washington, D.C. homicide rate goes up and down and up again. So let's take note of this one and see what we can find out.
I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, our panel of college students react to new news about HIV and AIDS, and we have a visit with the diva of divas, Ms. Patti LaBelle. She has a new Christmas album she wants to tell you about. But first, we want to talk about guns. For 3 decades, Washington, D.C. has had one of the toughest gun control laws in the country. It forbids most D.C. residents from buying, selling, or owning a handgun. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court announced it will hear a challenge to that law, only the second time in nearly 70 years that the court will examine the meaning of a constitutional amendment governing the right to keep and bear arms. The court ruling could decide whether gun control laws around the country will stand. Now, arguments about constitutional issues can seem very abstract, but here in D.C., the issue of guns is anything but. So joining me now are two Washington residents who've seen the effects of gun violence up close, but who have very different perspectives on the gun ban. Shelley Parker is one of the plaintiffs in the case that's being heard by the Supreme Court. She's on the phone from her home in Washington, D.C., and here with me in the studio is Ron Moulton. He has a brother who was killed by gun violence, and he himself used to hustle drugs on the streets of D.C., but he's turned his life around and co-founded Peaceaholics. It's an organization that tries to intervene in kinds of disputes that result in gun violence. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for speaking with us.
Nice to be here.
Shelley Parker, if I could begin with you, why did you become a party to this case? Do you want to own a gun, and why?
Yes, I am an advocate for owning a gun, and the reason I got into the case was because of the fact that I was on a street just outside of Capitol Hill that there was an individual that was pretty much terrorizing the street, dealing drugs, because no one could pretty much walk in and out of the house. So I got a lot of my neighbors to kind of become a little more proactive. And then one evening, he tried to break in my house. And that goes along with the rock that was thrown through the back of my window of my car, the rock that was thrown through the front of my house.
Well, Ron, what about you? What about Shelley's point?
shouldn't people be allowed to own a gun to defend themselves as they can in pretty much the rest of the country?
Well, I can relate to her. I just had a brick thrown through my office window because we were dealing with the issue of snitching, but I'm not going to go get the gun to deal with the people who threw the brick through my window. I'm going to go out to the community and try to help change the social ill that caused people to do it, think the way they think. So I understand her view, but I totally disagree with her.
Well, but tell me why.
Well, for several reasons. In America, since 9/11, 110,000 people have been murdered. And it's happened in states where we have handguns. So you can make the argument about having handguns and not having handguns, but we have to deal with the social ills that cause people to have the mentality to do these crimes. Then you have to look at, in our community in Washington, D.C., people don't want this law to change. So we have to deal with due process, the will of the people. Now, I'm not sure that the people who are plaintiffs in this case understand the impact of handguns. I understand because I see every day young people who don't have the right mentality out here with guns doing the things they're doing. And also, nobody's advocating for the people who are selling these guns to our children to get more time. And I have a problem with it.
Shelley, this law has been in fact for, what, 30 years or so. It seems to have the broad support of D.C. residents as well as the elected political leadership of the district. So shouldn't the will of the people be respected? That's what they want.
At a certain point, I'm not really in agreement with the fact that this is the will of the people. Maybe certain sections of the city are in agreement with states like this gun ban to stand. But I have really, in the 3 years that I've been involved in this case, I think I've only run into maybe two or three people who are, you know, still agree that this gun ban should stay in force. Furthermore, in response to the gentleman from Chief Hollis, I would also like to state that this is actually not necessarily about the social issues. I understand there are a lot of social issues going on in the city that are going to promote certain attitudes and problems that are going on in the city, but this is actually more about my Second Amendment right, which is that I do have this right to bear arms, to own a gun in my home. And once again, we're not trying to get a gun so I can strap it to my hip and walk around outside. This is just strictly for in my home.
Shelley, I think I would disagree with you about the consensus of most of the people in the city on this issue, but I want to bring in another voice now, and this is Valencia Muhammad. She's a former school board official, and she's lost two of her children to gun violence in the city, but she also supports repealing the gun ban. And Valencia, you told me in the past that you think the gun ban is racist. Why?
Well, in the beginning, it's my understanding that when we received home rule, that's one of the things that came with it. And for this gun ban, they had this super hype among a lot of African-Americans at that time where they were, you know, they were saying, oh, my God, we have all this, you know, this killing going on. We don't know how to act. Or we're not going to know how to, you know, defend ourselves or use these guns properly. So they had a big vote, and everybody voted. But, I mean, that was back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But we're talking about today. There's a whole new cadre of people that are coming into the city. They're coming in from states and cities where they have opportunities to exercise their Second Amendment rights. And they're bringing in their laptops, their couches, their new, you know, marble countertops. And they also have a gun. And they don't want to feel guilty about hiding that gun. So what they're saying is, no, I want the same inalienable rights that people have all over the United States.
But at the end of the day, your argument is that this is a legacy of an unwillingness to allow African Americans to own guns. And
yes.
And that basis that needs to be changed.
And
let me ask you this. Can you really argue that what the city needs is more guns? I mean, there have already been 170 murders in the city so far this year.
We have 5,000 deaths, according to the medical examiner's report, but the majority of them are not by guns. The majority of them are by poor health among African Americans. So if we're going to focus on deaths in the African American community, then let's focus more on health.
Well, the ban was put in effect in 1976, and there have been years in which there have been 400 or 500 murders in the city. As I mentioned, there have already been 170 murders in the city so far this year. Can you really argue that the gun ban is doing any good since the city is surrounded by two jurisdictions with more liberal laws? So is it really making any difference?
Well, let's look at our surrounding states. Let's go to Baltimore or Philly. You can have a gun there, right? And the murder rate is skyrocketing. So it doesn't mean anything about having a handgun that's going to stop violence or murder. Let's look at what Gandhi did in India through the science of nonviolence. That's how we want to deal with this stuff that's going on in our community. Let's look at Sean Taylor, his experience with guns. just locked
former
up for handguns, former Redskins.
Oh, I'm sorry, he is a current Redskins right. player who was tragically murdered earlier this week. Nobody really knows what the details are.
He was murdered by a handgun
in
and
Miami.
Locked up for having a handgun. I don't see nothing positive in having weapons. Look at us in Iraq with all the weapons in the world. We have insurgency over there that's beating our butt. And the same thing will happen out there. I mean, you give people guns, they break in your house, take guns, and we're not dealing with the issues that cause people to...
But if someone breaks into my home and takes my gun, that's more about me not being a responsible gun owner and doing something so someone can't get a hold of
it. But there are other laws, Shelley, that regulate the possibility that people might not be responsible dog owners. For example, we have rules regulating how you have to treat your dog because there are negative consequences. So the question I have, same question I have for... news that I had to lend you to Dan is listed, won't there be more gun-related deaths not only from street violence but from suicide, from accidents, from domestic disputes?
I mean, let's let Shelley
answer that question.
My response to that is, if you're worried about suicide rates, you need to address the mental health problems in the city. If we're worried about, children getting a hold of guns, we need to talk about parents that are irresponsible in letting their children get a hold of these guns. The same arguments you made about, irresponsible dog owners, they're irresponsible drivers. There are more people killed by automobiles in this area than there are people killed with guns. In response to the gentleman before, he was saying that he actually said the very thing I will say. He said that, the gun laws make no difference. In Maryland, you can have a gun, but look at the gun deaths in Baltimore. Yes. But look at D.C. We don't technically have one gun in this city by one citizen. So how is it we have 170-some-odd deaths in the city via guns?
I think your point is that the gun law is not doing any good.
There are a lot of guns in our community.
But that's your point.
People,
your point is that despite the gun ban, there are guns here anyway, so the only people not getting them are law-abiding citizens like her.
And it'd be even worse because people are bringing guns and selling them to our children every day. People from the military, people from the... who had drug problems to go to Virginia. I was a drug dealer. I used to go to West Virginia with a drug addict and buy every Mac 11, everything I wanted. I pointed to them in the store and brought them here. So once we get the guns, once you sell the guns here in D.C., it's going to be the same thing. And unfortunately, your community, people not selling guns to children in your community, they don't have the same problems as my children have. And I see them with guns and making bad decisions every day. And then it's not a big issue to Sean Teller's kill or to this newspaper guy's kill. And then everything, they changed the whole fire department to hide him getting killed. But my people get killed every day, and nobody's addressing these problems. I don't see people like you, sorry, in my community saying, what can I do to help? I guarantee you, you're not going outside on your block and asking them young guys, you're saying how you're going to get rid of them. You're not saying how you're going to go out there and help them. Young man, how can I help you get off my corner?
What
can I do to help?
Valencia, let's let Valencia have a thought here, because I'm letting Shelley, let me let Valencia in here, because Valencia, you have had two children killed through gun violence. And yet you still believe that the law should be repealed.
My whole thing is I am trying to exercise all of my rights as a free black woman who has had ancestors enslaved in this country. I want all of them, not here and there or a couple, and you take the majority away. I want every single thing that's coming to me that my ancestors did not get. And that's all I'm saying. In the meantime, yes, the African-American community and their leaders and the community activists need to be more responsible in terms of dealing with the youth. We've been, Peace and Holland has done a fantastic job, but they can't do the whole city. So there needs to be other operations like this that are working and focusing, that are being compensated by the federal and the local government to do what they got to do. And there's always been this segment in our community where they want to focus on the individuals, on these youth, as if they don't have parents. Well, there may be a missing daddy, but you got a present mama. Let's start working with that mama and her mindset. And if she knows that gun, illegal gun is in her house, stop looking the other way. Take it and turn it in.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you all for an important discussion, and perhaps you'll come back and talk to us as the court takes up this case, as it will later this spring. In our studio here at Valencia Muhammad, she lost two of her children to gun violence. She's the founder of a group called Mothers of Unsolved Murders in D.C., but she supports repealing the D.C. gun ban. We're also joined by Shelley Parker. She's one of the plaintiffs in the case being heard by the Supreme Court. She joined us on the phone from her home in Washington. Also with us, Ron Moulton, who is a brother who's killed by gun violence in D.C. He is co-founder of Keep the Holler. an organization that tries to intervene in disputes on the street. Thank you so much for speaking with us, all of you.
Thank you.
Well, that's an interesting presentation of different views on that particular gun law in Washington, D.C., and I think the perspectives there, at least one of those you don't hear very often, the one that has liberated blacks going all the way back to slavery when D.C. got the Home Rule charter, then, you know, they were not allowing the blacks to have guns, and she interprets that as being racist, and they're believing because of the high homicide rate there that that was in fact a racist law. And Ron, the gentleman there, unfortunately he had somebody shot in his family too, but and he had been a criminal and knew a little bit about the business, I suppose. But you know, the idea that having guns doesn't do anything for the crime rate, I'm not sure that's true, because we've got a substantial number of studies now led by no one less than John Lott Jr., who did the definitive work in his book, No Guns, Less Crime, and he updated that book. And if you haven't had a chance to look at it, it's only $12 or $13 new in the bookstores, and you could probably get it much cheaper off of eBay or some other used book site. But what he did is he looked at the data in like 3,000 counties across the United States and used a time series type of study to show that as the right to carry laws increased in counties across the United States, in a matter of a year or two, the crime rates began to go down. And the idea is there that even criminals are smart enough to figure out that if I'm looking for people on the street in order to rob, and that's one of the crimes, of course, we fear the most, then I may think twice because a number of people in the community have, a large number of people in the community have right to carry laws. So you never know who you're picking on. You never know when you're going to get shot yourself. And 97% of the cases where a felon confronts a law-abiding citizen who pulls a gun on him, there's no shooting involved. The felon just simply takes off and says, I'll come back and fight another day. I'll look for a victim that that isn't armed. That's particularly been the case with women out by themselves on an evening, perhaps on a weekend or something like that. So it's an interesting argument, and D.C.'s going to make or the United States Supreme Court's going to make a ruling in this case. And of course, they're not only going to deal with the D.C. gun law, but they're going to probably have something to say for the first time since 1936, I believe the year was. They're going to have something to say about, does the Second Amendment actually refer to a citizen's right to carry a firearm or own a firearm, possess a firearm, or were, in fact, they talking about the militia when they wrote that amendment to the Constitution? And we have had courts, lower-level courts, come down on both sides of that. But even if they say it's just it's wide open and that they meant citizens, that still will not mean that various states can't have some type of restrictions on the carrying of firearms, because what we're always trying to do is balance order and liberty all the time. So very interesting case, and we'll look forward to that one. And Audrey, the one that you were a little frightened about here, I think, is this next one that we'll take a look at. This has to do with the business of cyberbullies, and what an interesting subject. And you know, that internet is loaded with a lot of wonderful things, but it's also loaded with some strange people and strange events. So we'll go ahead and take a look at this one and see what you think of that.
Support for NPR comes from Global Giving, bringing the power of grassroots philanthropy to the internet. Learn more about holiday giving opportunities at globalgiving.org.
There are so many disturbing aspects about the story of Megan Meyer. Now, she's a 13-year-old Missouri girl who took her own life about a year ago after a boy who befriended her online turned on her. The Beltway neighbor later admitted in a police report that she was that boy, that she made him up because her daughter and Megan were in dispute, and she wanted, quote, find out what Megan was saying online.
Now, Megan's family wants the adult neighbor punished. But at the time Megan died a year ago, there weren't any laws on the books. So last week, officials in her hometown unanimously passed a measure making internet harassment a misdemeanor punishable by up to $500 in fines and 90 days in jail. Now, as for the rest of the country, 32 states have some sort of law about offline bullying. That's according to a watchdog group. But online issues need to be addressed. We put a report out this week from the Journal of Adolescent Health because 11% of middle school students surveyed said they were bullied online in the last 2 months. And the CDC reports that cyberbullying by instant message, chat rooms, and cell phones left up about 50% from 5 years ago. Pepperdine Associate Professor Naomi Harlan Goodnow has written about the issue for the Missouri Law Journal. Her work, Cyberstalking, a New Crime, Evaluating the Effectiveness of the Current State and Federal Laws. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. I want to just get some baseline definitions here. What's the distinction that you make between cyber harassment and cyberbullying?
That is a good question. Generally speaking, cyber harassment or cyber stalking is the type of behavior that we would want to criminalize. Cyberbullying is bad behavior, but maybe not to the point where we would be seeking at least a felony type of conviction. Now, those are terms, the way I define those terms, and the truth is kind of all over the board right now how people are using those terms. Some people use the term cyberbullying to mean cyber harassment and cyber stalking in the way that I use them. So as we go forward in this discussion over the next year or so, I think it's going to get more and more important that we understand these different terms and define them.
So in the case of this young girl, Megan Meyer, where does her case fall?
That is a great question. It depends on what state you're in, and it depends on what laws are in place in that state. The article that I wrote basically takes a look at all of the state and federal laws and where they are. The truth is they are all over the board. So in some states, it's possible that what happened to her might fall under a criminal statute. In other states, statutes just fall far short of dealing with the Megan Meyer case or other similar cases.
Now, there are laws related to terrestrial stalking, harassment, and bullying. Why can't they be applied to the cyber equivalent?
Well, there's sometimes they can, but generally speaking, I would say they fall short in at least in two ways. One way is a lot of them, what I call offline stalking or traditional harassment, when we think of the creepy guy hiding behind the bush and following you from your office to your car. A lot of those statutes require what they call a credible threat or a true threat, and that means in order for the statute to trigger, the individual stalker has to specifically threaten bodily injury of the victim. Now, in a case like Megan Meyer, that could be a problem because we're seeing here more of a harassment, but no specific threat. And there was actually a case that came out in 1997 that dealt with this issue. There was a college student who was writing torture and snuff stories, very violent, sexual rape, killing people, and he had mentioned the name of a person down the hall from him in one of these stories, and he posted it online. Because that story was never sent directly to her, it was not a threat to her, and he was not prosecuted by the prosecution cell. The other way is that the statutes are falling short is what I call causing third parties to do harassment for you, or what other scholars have called harassment by proxy.
What does that mean?
That means, well, in a couple of ways. One is a stalker will take on the identity of the victim and go online as that victim.
And start doing things online in that person's name.
Absolutely, and then get third parties to harass them. Example, in California, there was a woman whose disgruntled boyfriend took on her identity, went online, said, "I'd like to be gang raped," gave her phone number and her address, and six men actually came to her.
Oh, my gosh.
So that is terrifying. And in New York, something very similar happened. A disgruntled business acquaintance took on the identity of somebody, or the victim, and started writing emails to pornographers and drug dealers and Satanists using her name, and those people responded and basically said, next time we hear about you, it's going to be in a police report. You better get a gun. And unfortunately, she had no legal recourse, which is why right now I believe your legislature in New York is looking at a cyber stalking bill.
How do you email a drug dealer?
I think it's a great question. I'm not sure. It's amazing. Something I keep thinking about as we have this discussion is this fuzzy line. And the local law enforcement in the Megan Meyer case in Missouri, you know, they said that this may have been rude. This is a quote. The adult's behavior might have been rude. It might have been immature, but it wasn't illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow doesn't seem right.
Yeah, and I think part of that is the laws that are in place in Missouri focus mainly on credible threats, those types of cases I was talking about where there are threats. There are some state statutes, Ohio is a great example, where they've adopted basically what I call a reasonable person standard. And what that law says is this would the conduct cause a reasonable person to fear bodily injury or to suffer severe emotional distress. And so in the Megan Meyer case, what would happen is if it did get to a jury, the jury would have to decide would, you know, a reasonable person in Megan Meyer's situation react the way that she did.
We've been talking about state law, but what about federal law?
There are three statutes that are pretty good. One is the telephone harassment statute, which was recently amended to include electronic communications. What's interesting about that is in order for that statute to be triggered, the person, the stalker, has to be anonymous, which is kind of strange, but sometimes they're not. There is in another statute called the Interstate Stalking Punishment and Prevention Act. It actually does adopt the reasonable person standard.
And what's the third one quickly?
And the third one is the Interstate Communications Act.
Pepperdine Associate Professor Naomi Harlan Goodnow, thank you so much for helping us understand this story a little better.
Yes, thank you.
Coming up on the Bryan Park Project, what you talking about?
Well, I think one of the things that piece shows is how complicated these laws are now, and we're getting a lot of action in legislatures and committees of legislatures to come up with legislation that will properly prosecute the people that need to be prosecuted, and I guess just put in the classification of bizarre and unfriendly this other category of people that spend their life on the internet and like to harass other people. It's interesting that reasonable person statute that Ohio uses that the professor mentioned, that if they use the standard that it would be against the law if a reasonable person would be afraid based on what this person actually did. And you can imagine both prosecutorial deliberations and jury deliberations on trying to figure this out. But with any new technology, I guess we can't call the internet new at this point, but amidst all of the very wonderful things of music and poetry and literature and news and research, you have these what I would call creeps hanging out online by the millions, and it's certainly certainly an odd thing. Hey, one more story here tonight about stop and frisk in New York City, and I think it's a very interesting story. We probably can't hear all of it tonight, but I'd like to play this. And, you know, New York City has this incredibly low crime rate. They've only had 35 stranger homicides this year. And a New York Post reporter was caught up in a stop-and-frisk case. And I think what I'll do is just play a little bit of this for you and see what you think about it.
I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, if you're looking for a way to do some good this holiday season, we have some ideas for you. Today, we'll tell you about a program to help out teachers and school kids around the country. You get to choose. That's next. But first, we're going to continue the conversation about New York's Stop and Frisk program. We just heard from New York Post reporter Leonardo O'Flair about his recent encounter with the police. He wrote about it in Sunday's paper. We're joined now by New York Police Department Deputy Commissioner for Public Information, Paul Brown. Mr. Brown, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, Commissioner, I know you heard Mr. Blair talk about his encounter. What do you know about the officer's side of the story? What was it that Mr. Blair was doing that affected their attention in their account?
Well, they're in a state patrol in a part of the Bronx, incidentally, I know very well because I grew up there, where there had been an increase in break-ins crime is down throughout the city, but in this particular area, there's been an increase in larceny, specifically break-ins to parked cars. This is a black Latino neighborhood. The officers who were patrolling this small sector, when I talk about a sector, maybe about 6 or 7 square blocks, in that small sector, there had been 27 cars. The neighbors, again, these are black and Hispanic people whose cars are being broken into.
And who are the officers, clearly, who are also African-American and Latino?
Correct. And they're looking to the police to try to do something about car breaking, among others. That's what one of the things these officers are looking for. They come on the street, it's isolated except for one person, young man, leaving from the direction of a car. They don't see him park it, with a bag in his hand. They roll up on him and say, "What were you doing coming from the car?" And the glare says that's exactly what happened. His response was, "What?" And they said, the officer said, don't you understand English? He responded in Spanish, which I think was an outrageous, condescending thing to do to a Latino officer. But the officer, to his credit, then proceeded to take that at face value and questioned him in Spanish. Obviously, he at some point said he speaks English. So I think you have the police making a legitimate right of inquiry. To describe this as racial profile is absurd. If you have a black officer, a Latino officer, and a largely black and Latino neighborhood responding to complaints of black and Latino car owners, and you have one person on an isolated street leaving the city of car, they're just asking him, what were you doing coming from the car? He had the option of saying, I just parked my car there and went, and I live nearby or I'm living with relatives. And identifying himself. Said he refused to answer questions. What he didn't tell you was he tightly folded his arms, put his hands under his armpit, refused repeated directives to show his hand.
I'm forgive me, but we weren't able to get that part of the conversation on the air. But after we got off the air, he told us that that's not true. He said that part of the conversation simply never happened. He put his hand under his armpit. He says he knows the police say he did that. He says that never happened. I don't know what to make of that.
I believe the office of the county have two officers of the county have no reason not to. It doesn't change the fact that he's being uncooperative and not responding to legitimate inquiry.
How do you respond to his question about tone? He says it may have been a legitimate inquiry, but the way they spoke to him, and this is, certainly I'm sure you've heard this before, he says that they made him feel like he was garbage, that he was not a citizen, that he was a suspect, and he was a suspect before he was a citizen.
You know,
how do you respond to that?
Of it, I can relate his story in many accounts. In addition to living there, I also went to Columbia University, graduate school of journalism as a young man, when the city was a little more dangerous than it is now. But Columbia was very good at instilling elitism. And, you know, we felt very sure of ourselves, and that there was a tendency among the elite, you know, colleges to view cops as just working class. And how dare they stop and fire a snake. So I think that has to be taken into consideration.
I understand your point, but Commissioner, with respect, I don't believe you answered my question. His question was,
what are you doing coming from the car? They asked him, what are you doing coming from the car? He refused to answer that question.
Okay. According to the Post and to a recent study by the RAND Corporation that was commissioned by the NYPD, complaints about the department have risen dramatically. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I think what the CTRB attributed to is the fact that it's become what the Post account didn't say, use of force, the most serious complaints about police have actually declined. And what CTRB attributes to, in other words, the agency investigating these complaints and recording the increase attributes it to the fact that a number of years ago they went to a system where you can make complaints by 311. They made it a lot easier.
Complaints against the police, that's a whole other subject, but you got to remember in the 1990s, New York City had some of the highest, or early 1990s, the highest crime rates in the nation, killing almost 2,200 people, and this year it looks like they're going to come in under 500, and we can attribute a lot of that decline to aggressive police work on the street, illegal but aggressive, and So many times there is a confusion between the conversation between cop and a citizen. Many citizens are, of course, are afraid of the police. Police officers need to remember that. So sometimes they don't respond immediately or respond in the wrong way. And it's really, that germinates from fear. And that can cause this spiraling escalation of emotions where somebody in literally seconds or a minute or so could get hurt. I don't know enough about this case with the New York Post reporter, but it sounds sounds as if something something went awry there. These are never perfect relationships, and I don't know what the answer to that is. But I suspect that New York City police are trying to do the best job they can under the circumstances, and everybody doesn't understand that. I always wanted to write a book called How to Meet Your Local Police Officer and Live to Tell About It, but I never have. But anyway, what we'll do tonight is go ahead and sign off. And I think what's going to happen here very shortly is that we'll have another show planned for you next week, and we'll see what happens then. And we'll be seeing you again. And take care, and be careful shopping if you're going to be out there this weekend.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.